Costco versus Ramser et al., John Blazer, Appellant's Counsel, Susan Mitchell, Matthew Banks, Catherine Donnelly, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, Mr. Blazer, you may proceed.
Good morning. If it please the court, my name is John Blazer, counsel for Plaintiff Appellant Astrid Costco. I assume everyone can hear me and see me. I may proceed. This case went to trial in the Circuit Court for Fauquier County in August of 2019. On the second day of trial, following a contested ruling, plaintiff took a non-suit, her first, pursuant to Virginia Code Section 81380. There was a dispute about the wording of the order of non-suit, and a hearing was held September 11th, at which time the order of non-suit was entered. That order contained no language suspending any Rule 1:1 finality pending decision on any other issues. No transcript of the September 11th hearing has been included in the record on appeal. 2 days later, on September 13th, defendants filed a motion for costs pursuant to 801380 subsection C. Such motions are not automatic or mandatory. They are elective and discretionary with defendants who have been confronted with a non-suit within that 7-day period of time.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you a question? Do I have my facts right that the court held a hearing on October 1 in which the plaintiff's counsel, I assume it was you, asked for a suspending order, and the court orally granted the suspension motion from the bench on October 1, is that right?
You are absolutely correct. The background is that we were scheduled to go on an extended trip out of the country, part business, part pleasure, and I did not want any timetables to be encountered while I was unable to respond.
Right, I follow that, and I'm not implicitly criticizing that at all. What I'm getting at is the distinction between the rendition of a judgment and the entry of a judgment for purposes of 1:1. The quote is from Jefferson, our opinion in 2005. The rendition of a judgment must be distinguished from its entry on the court's records. The rendition of a judgment duly pronounces the judicial act of the court, and the entry or recording of the instrument memorializing the judgment does not constitute an integral part of and should not be confused with the judgment itself. And that quote has been used both in the Court of Appeals and by us to say, look, the court speaks through its orders to determine what the judgment is, but the rendition of judgment happens as soon as the judgment is declared from the bench. So my question is, our case law is not that clear. I'm not implying it is. But as best as you can tell from our case law, why didn't the judge, before the expiration of 21 days, suspend the final order? There was obviously something that needed to be addressed. There was a motion for costs. He ruled for the defendant on October 1. There's still something left to be done, which is enter an order saying it. But all that happened before but the entry of the order happened before the expiration of 21 days. So what's your best take on how we should deal with that? Do we just say too bad, so sad?
Well, two things. First of all, the argument is being made that costs resolution are ministerial in nature and do not derail the finality. The problem with that argument here is that the costs motion was not pending at the
time. I'm sorry to interrupt, but my question is a little more narrow than that. My question is, if the court resolved the issue that was pending within 21 days and orally declared, he didn't take it under advisement, He says, I'm ruling right now. I'm going to walk off the bench, and I'm done. I'll enter whatever order you guys present to me. I'm granting the fees, and I'm suspending until December 1 the final entry. Why isn't that enough for Rule 1:1? He had jurisdiction on the day that he did that, active jurisdiction.
He had jurisdiction on October 1st, I agree. But that was the 20th day following entry of the order of non-suit. No, it is undisputed that no order was entered on either the 20th or 21st day. And even if you accept the argument that judgment was rendered, albeit not entered in a written order, through which we have been constantly reminded that the court speaks through its written orders as of the date of their entry. Nonetheless, this matter lingered until November 5th, when the court summoned the parties to one way or the other resolve it. And so even by virtue of your recitation and recollection of the events of October 1st, I think this matter was long overdue and that the court had lost jurisdiction.
When you speak of jurisdiction, are you saying subject matter jurisdiction?
I understand that there is some issue about how fine that matter must be articulated, and I think it is at least subject matter jurisdiction. Beyond that,
so a court can expand or contract by court rule, not by statute or by constitutional provision. A court can define its own boundaries of subject matter jurisdiction. Is there any authority for that?
Not as I sit here today, Your Honor, not that I know of.
Well, if we're able to amend our rules in, say, 22 days, 23 days, 1,000 days, and expand or contract our subject matter jurisdiction, I think the General Assembly would consider that to be an awful broad assertion of judicial power. And if it's not subject matter jurisdiction, that means all it is active jurisdiction. And active jurisdiction has limitations.
Correct. And the law, the rule 1:1 says quite clearly 21 days and no longer. And until that is changed, that's what we have to deal with.
Thank you. Please proceed. Yes, please do.
As I said, it was undisputed that no order was entered within 21 days of the entry of the order of non-suit, which occurred on September 11th. Now, on October 16th, plaintiff was presented with an order. Admittedly, I was reluctant to endorse that order. However, 2 days later, upon reflection and reconstruction of the timeline, I realized that this argument had to be made, that the court had lost jurisdiction 21 days after September 11th, notwithstanding oral ruling from the bench on October 1st with regard to any extension until December 1st or whatever the date was. Consequently, I made that objection and carried it to the court on October 18th, and the court waited until November 5th for whatever reason to summon the parties. Through some scheduling snafu, apparently counsel for the defendant appellees was not advised, did not show up, did not arrange for a court reporter. The judge, on his own initiative, proceeded to rule after counsel had left the courtroom. He dispensed with endorsement pursuant to Rule 5:13. And nonetheless, in his written orders of November 5th, he acknowledged receipt of counsel, my objection of October 18th, declaring or advising that the court had lost jurisdiction. Nonetheless, he proceeded to enter a written order without endorsement, confirming the cost award he had made on October 1st.
Mr. Blazer, can I ask you a question, please?
Yes.
You seem to be suggesting that the statute, 801.380, subsection C, in some way, shape, or form, modifies Rule 1:1 in the manner in which it has been utilized for quite some time. What is it?
Oh, I don't believe that it does. I am simply saying that that is an argument in opposition to my position that has been used.
All right, so that's not your position, but it is your opponent's position, and you say that he is incorrect. Why is he incorrect?
Because the matter was not filed prior. I mean, I'm not saying that under any circumstance subsection C operates to extend the Rule 1:1 finality, but it is particularly clear that if the motion for costs pursuant to subsection C has not been filed as of entry of the order of non-suit, it certainly cannot be considered pending under any interpretation of Rule 1:1 for execution of ministerial and administrative tasks. So,
but it was, counsel, it was pending on day 20. In fact, it was pending and specifically ruled on and finally ruled on. The only thing left to do is to sign the piece of paper,
which was not done.
So let me go back to 1:1. It reads in A, all final judgments, ... remain under the control of the trial court and may be modified, vacated, or suspended for 21 days. Right? Okay, so
correct.
On day 20, the trial court doesn't have control over granting a motion for costs. A trial court doesn't have control to suspend the judgment. And if he waits until 1 a.m. on day 20 into day 21, he lost the control he had the day before. So, I mean, all this gets back to the rendition versus entry point. And it's to me, it's logically the most important question. And it's fair to say that we've not done a great job of distinguishing those two concepts. But they're there in the law. A judgment is rendered when it's finally declared. So this judge, within 20 days, quote, exercised control over the final judgment. He added something, which is the cost claim, and he suspended it. So we're going to tell him he lost control because he didn't sign the document before the witching hour of midnight that night. I'm asking you to tell me if there's a Virginia case that says, that's right, that's just what we've said, then that's the law. But tell me there is a case, because I haven't found it quite as clearly as you suggest.
And I'm not suggesting that my research skills are any better than yours. Certainly, this is a matter that comes up fairly often, where the trial judge or motions judge is asked to keep something on his desk longer than the 21 days of Rule 1:1. And it has been the practice in all the years that I've been involved that everyone is extremely sensitive to the fact that if you are running up against a Rule 1:1 issue, get something in writing.
I completely agree. I had the same paranoia when I was a lawyer, but paranoia is not the same thing as a legal principle.
Well, nonetheless, it has guided those of us in the active trial practice that mm-hmm. that prudence at a minimum dictates that that would be done. And in the absence of a clear decision from your court, that is the law with which we have dealt and will continue to deal.
That your time has expired. Your time has expired. Thank you very much.
I think the court's well aware of my position.
Is it Ms. Mitchell or Ms. Donnelly who will argue?
Good morning, sir. Susan Mitchell on behalf of the appellees. May it please
Ms. Mitchell,
the court.
Can I ask a first question on this to try to narrow it? When we're talking about what is a final order for the purpose of having a final order to make the case appealable, we have interpreted Rule 1:1 to require either a vacation of the order itself to get you out of that problem, or an amendment to it. But in this case, subsection C of 801.380 appears to somebody to have an effect on Rule 1:1. What is your position?
Yes, sir. It's not the appellee's position that the statute itself has an effect on Rule 1:1, but the statute specific subsection must be looked at to determine whether this particular order meets your court's definition of finality under Rule 1:1. So we're not suggesting, Your Honor, that the statute, although it could, because we know statutes, according to the General Assembly, to use the colloquial term, trump the rule, but we're not suggesting that's the case here. What we are suggesting is that when the court looks at its own definition of what is a final order, judgment, or decree, the fact that the 380C motion was pending and ruled upon within 21 days necessarily means that the three factors written in the conjunctive of Rule 1:1B were not met by the September 11 non-suit order. And therefore, to use the language of the court from James versus James 2002, the non-suit order did not, quote, become final upon expiration of the 21-day period. I was reminded when I read that orders are not instantaneously final. Just like a butterfly doesn't start as a butterfly, it's a caterpillar first. It becomes final. And in this case, that non-suit order was not a final order for purposes of Rule 1:1 unless and until certain conditions were met, namely those conditions that the court sets out in subsection B of the rule. Did it?
But there is a problem, Counselor. There's a problem with that argument, even though it's a great thesis. We have a lot of cases that say that if you have a post-trial motion and the trial judge, you know, pocket vetoes it, it is a too bad, so sad situation. So it can't simply be that you file a request for costs after the case is completely over, because we'd have to reverse a lot of cases to get to that result. The weird thing about your case, as the Chief is alluding, is you got a decision from the bench, a rendition of judgment. I order that these costs be paid. Done. And it happened within 20 days. And so is that control of the trial court within 20 days? I think the trial judge thought so.
Absolutely. And I would submit that the parties thought so as well, including Costco in this case, given the statements made that Your Honor has already pointed out to in that October 1 transcript, which is part of the record before this court. With regard to your first comment, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that case law would have to be overturned or reversed, because in my research, none of the decisions addressing finality as relates to non-suit took up the issue of the interplay between 380C and Rule 1:1 and the concept of finality. And the reason that I believe that there is a distinction to be made there and why 380C has to be examined as a matter of first impression today is because in 380C, my clients did not have a right that existed prior to the taking of the non-suit. The claim, if I use the language of Rule 1:1b, came into existence once plaintiff voluntarily chose to non-suit in the middle of trial. Instead of ending something, which is what a non-suit typically does, it ends the claims, it resolves the matters in controversy, perhaps temporarily, but perhaps for good. Here, the timing of the non-suit actually commenced something. My client's new claim to seek reimbursement of costs and fees occasioned solely by virtue of the timing of the non-suit. And that's where I believe the distinction lies.
To understand what you're saying, I think it follows up on what the chief was asking you about. By statute, you have nothing accrued whatsoever until after the non-suit is actually entered. And then that creates a open issue that you filed a motion on, and there's obviously more to be done in the case for it to be final.
Yes, sir, which is why the September 11 order did not, quote, become final under Rule 1:1b, because it did not dispose of the entire matter, including all claims and all causes of action against all parties. It did not give all relief contemplated, and it did not leave nothing to be done by the court except the ministerial execution of the judgment, order, or decree. It, in fact, did the opposite and gave rise to necessarily additional things to be done.
So linguistically, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You go ahead, Justice Kelsey.
So you're saying linguistically, 1:1b says everything's final if you've addressed everything that's on the table today, but all relief contemplated takes into account a statutory claim that arises after the entry of the order of non-suit.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, counsel, how does that differ from someone winning their case and not being entitled to attorney's fees until the court says you win? At that point, under any normal case, if attorney's fees are statutorily provided or otherwise provided, their right to attorney's fees does not accrue even under your definition until the court says you win. And we have numerous cases which say that, I believe they say that even if you request those attorney's fees, unless the court awards them and puts them in an order before 21 days expires, you lose the attorney's fee. So why does your argument differ from that?
There you go.
Because in the circumstance that Your Honor just posed, the basis for the claim for attorney's fees would be intrinsically wrapped up in the substance of the underlying claim or controversy between the parties. Perhaps, for example, it was a term in a contract, or perhaps because some statutory provision based upon the substantive law at issue allows for that recovery. Here, our right to fees and costs is in no way, shape, or form tied to the underlying substantive medical malpractice case that brought us to trial in the first place. Rather, it was the procedural tool, as this court has called it, the tactical weapon that plaintiff chose to deploy at the time that plaintiff chose to deploy it, that gave rise to the claim for costs and fees. And it was procedural, not substantive, in the sense that the court just posed that hypothetical. So we believe that that would be a significant distinction that allows for this order to not become final once we avail ourselves of the response to that tactical weapon. Namely, you can deploy it, but there are restraints and constraints, and one of those is you may be called upon to pay us what we spent to get our case ready to go to trial, but for your non-suit.
Aren't you entitled to certain basic costs?
anyway. And so wouldn't the ruling on this this quirky little non-suit case have sweeping implications for the finality of orders across the board, where someone says, well, what about, you know, certain costs that I may be entitled to by rule or by statute?
As best as I've considered it, no, Your Honor, it would not. Because at least in the area that I practice, and of course those other cases aren't before you this morning, but in the personal injury medical malpractice arena, costs lie where they lie. The winning party isn't entitled to them. The losing party certainly isn't. They lie with each party respectively. And while you can perhaps seek to get witness subpoena fees, you cannot get cost shifting in the sense of experts and those big ticket items like the General Assembly deemed was appropriate in subsection C of 801.380. Respectfully believe that this court's decision today would be held within the confines of 801.380C and this particular set of facts, which we know the court is comfortable and has done many times over, issue decisions that directs counsel to the fact that the decision is being made based upon the facts of the specific case presented.
If the fulcrum on which your case turns is in response to Justice Kelsey's question, are that cost may be discretionary, these fees are discretionary.
Yes.
So I'm still not understanding the fine distinction that you're drawing.
Yes, ma'am. The grant of the fees is discretionary, although the court is empowered with the word shall to determine the reasonableness of those fees. But the trigger for my claim, my client's claim, to seek the fees and the costs is not a matter of discretion. The trigger was deployed when the non-suit was taken on day two of trial. And that trigger could not have been squeezed. It was not available to my clients if Costco had non-suited 8 days prior to trial. So we are dealing with a very limited factual set of circumstances based upon the timing of the non-suit. And it is plaintiff who brought that claim into being, brought that action, that right into being. Justice Kelsey, you had asked the question regarding jurisdiction, sir. And we had raised this issue in our brief, and we agree with the court that the court by rule cannot expand or contract its own jurisdiction. That is a matter for the Constitution or for the legislature.
And well, so technically, it can't expand or contract its subject matter jurisdiction,
yes,
but we can, of course, with active jurisdiction.
Yes, sir. And the Court of Appeals decision that we included in our brief, as well as this court's decision in the Board of Supervisors versus Board of Zoning, it's an interesting discussion of perhaps too loose a use of the term jurisdiction when dealing with the constraints that Rule 1:1 places on trial courts, and perhaps we should be more precise in our language. But it is our position that this court absolutely maintains subject matter jurisdiction over Costco and Ramser.
Right. Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes, sir.
I follow what you're saying. Let me ask you this. In terms of our case law, because this is the problem. The problem in this debate we're having is not logic. It's not even legal reasoning. It's a carpet of different colors of cases. Do we have any cases that would address this? A trial judge enters a criminal conviction, and then on day 20 says, I have made a gigantic mistake. He says it from the bench. I vacate the criminal conviction. There's been a travesty of justice here. I vacate it. But he enters the order 22 days after the conviction order had been entered, but he orders from the bench that it be vacated on day 20. What case would say that, he's still convicted?
I'm not aware of a case that says that, and I am obligated ethically to point the court to the one case that I am aware of that doesn't help my case. But nonetheless, it is before the court, and Mr. Blazer cited it in his brief. It is the Wagner versus Sherd case, 257 Virginia 584, decided by the court in 1999. And at page 587, the court said the following: there is a distinction between the rendition of a judgment and the entry of a judgment. While the circuit court may have rendered its judgment on Sherd's motion for remittitor at the conclusion of the hearing on February 24, it did not enter that judgment until April 21, 1998. At that time,
I see that and follow that, but that's not dealing with 1:1. It's dealing with the 30-day provision.
It
is. And so, in the 30-day provision, tell me if I'm right, is a statutory provision.
Yes, sir.
So as far as I know, tell me if I'm wrong, as far as I know, and I'm not sure of this, there are no 1:1 rule-based decisions that say that a trial judge who vacates a criminal conviction on day 20 but enters the order on day 22 hadn't done anything.
We certainly didn't find one. The Wagner case gave me pause because of the distinction language between rendition and entry. And that's why I prefaced the quote with those comments. But I did not find one, sir. And too bad, so sad, I would lead to an inequitable result in this case. We ask the court to affirm the lower court's actions.
All right. Thank you very much. Your time has expired. The court will be in recess for approximately 15 minutes and will resume at 11:05.